KPTZ now joins the Board of County Commissioners' weekly meeting for this week's public health updates on COVID-19, live from the Jefferson County Courthouse. This is KPTZ Port Townsend, and we will join the commissioners who, as they say, in progress. I'll be right back after the meeting is over.
Well prepared. And we'll welcome the listeners from KPTZ as well for our weekly update. Dr. Bach, national numbers continue to look bad, but I can't wipe the smile off my face. How are we doing?
Well, you summarized it exactly. In terms of the national numbers, they are looking bad. We've now crossed the 10 million mark in terms of confirmed cases in the U.S. And we know the true number of cases is much higher than that. And significantly, those case reports have increased now by 59% over the last 2 weeks. So a very rapid increase. The United States is now averaging around 110,000 new cases per day. And death rate is going up. It's averaging around 800 deaths per day. And this is less than the initial spring surge, where it was over 1,000 a day, but it's slowly creeping up. And that's what we've long known happens when the total case numbers go up. So we're seeing that. And the brunt of the current outbreak is in these northern tier states, the Dakotas and Iowa, Wisconsin, Nebraska, these areas where winter is coming. It's getting colder, people are staying indoors more, those risk factors are kicking in. It's also these states that have been less than aggressive in terms of masking and mitigation efforts, and that's changing. They realize that's really the only way to control these kind of outbreaks. So one by another, these states are kind of coming around and adopting the practices that a lot of us have been doing since March. There are some Northeast states that are starting to go back to stay at home recommendations. They're not orders, but they're strong advisories for people who have high-risk conditions or COVID-19 complications to stay at home, that it's becoming less and less safe to be out and about in communities as the outbreak increase. In Washington, things are going up as well. We're over our total case counts over 122,000. And if you look just at the last 2 weeks, where our case rates are going up even faster than the national rate. So Washington State went up by 89% over the last 2 weeks. Now that's starting at a much lower level than where the country as a whole is. But it especially represents what's going on in eastern Washington and these kind of lingering high rates in the I-5 corridor. So in this state, we're now seeing 1,300 cases a day is the average. That compares to at our low point in the early summer, we were down to a couple hundred cases a day. So that's going up. The death rate is going up slowly, although we've been fairly successful at holding that down. Jefferson County, we've had an increase in this last week. So we've had 8 new cases over the last week. Our case count, we're still doing one investigation from yesterday, but our case count probably will go up to, it's at 95, it will go up to 96. Our percent positivity, that is the number of tests that are done that test positive, is staying below 1%. So that's good. Our target is to keep below 2%. But with those increased cases, our our case rate per 100,000 will now go up from, it was at 25, it will go up to 34.48 today. So we're out of that kind of optimal below 25 rate and moving into the moderate risk. And
Tom, can you characterize what kind of transmission, whether it's in-county or out-of-county exposures, do we know?
It's both, but definitely some in-county, some cluster type things, parties where there's been transmission, so gatherings, travel out of county, we think is linked to some cases, visitors from out of county who ended up testing positive, and some we don't know. We can't always find the origin of the infection, but we're trying more and more to do that because we think that's one of the keys to control. If we can find the outbreak that started off the cases, we're more likely to find more cases and then more opportunities for control. Throughout the region, I initially, I get these numbers, I look on the state's risk assessment dashboard, but it's not correlating very well with what the counties are reporting. And if people want to have the most accurate information on case rates, it's really best to go to the individual county website. So as an example, Clallam County is listed at 30 cases per 100,000 and 1.4% positivity, but on their website, it's lower. It's 26 per 100,000 and 1.6% positivity. Not a big difference there. But Kitsap's is listed on the state website as 51 per 100,000, and they just announced that on Friday they went above 75. So they're, by their calculations, they are at 78 cases per 100,000 and up to 4.1% positivity of the tests they're doing. And that's very significant in terms of school openings. Because of those numbers, they've decided not to do in-person schooling at least until January. So plans that, as I understand, plans that were in place to try to start some in-person education in Kitsap County are now on hold. The Mason County is at 58 cases per 100,000 and 2.1% positivity. And for comparison, statewide, it's 125 cases per 100,000. So significantly higher than the Olympic or Kitsap Peninsulas. And there's a number of hot spots. As I reported last week, Spokane County is one of them, and it's gotten even worse. Now it's 237 cases per 100,000 in Spokane. Assotin County, which is on the border with Lewiston, Idaho, on the other side, is there at 373 cases per 100,000 and 18.6% positivity. So almost one in five tests they do is testing positive. And Walla Walla, which is a much larger city, is at 300 per 100,000. And 8% of the tests are coming back positive. So that's kind of a preview of what a third wave looks like, is when those rates start going up. And we definitely are in the early stages of this long-predicted fall-winter third wave. We are seeing a slight increase in cold-like symptoms. But it's as far as we can detect through our surveillance, it's 0% influenza. There is simply no influenza in Washington State right now. We're testing a lot of people. We have not gotten any positive tests. We are finding very low levels of some other common cold viruses, specifically what's called metapneumovirus and rhinovirus. And these are very common viruses at this time of year. But even there, the levels are much lower than we would expect at this time of year. And that's, of course, because of the masking and distancing and the extra hygiene precautions that people are taking. What we urge people to look at is any respiratory illness, so any fever with cough or sore throat or nasal congestion, that is COVID-19 until proven otherwise. So everybody with cold symptoms should be tested for COVID-19. And in Jefferson County, that 99% of those tests are coming back negative. But we still need to do it because we need to find that needle in the haystack if we're going to be able to successfully control this. And then I was thinking to myself that this is sort of the moment of truth in terms of how it's going to be our ultimate test of how well we can control the transmission of this virus. But moment of truth may not be the right term when we're talking about a 3 to 4 month period that we're going to be tested over. So it's going to be many moments of truth. But it's going to be, how successful we are in applying what we've learned. And what we've learned is with COVID-19, transmission is very much linked to behavior. It has to do with how well you adhere to masking and distancing and hygiene standards. It has to do with public gatherings. It has to do with travel and out-of-town visitors, or if we travel to other areas. And it's something as a nation we are not doing well on. And a lot of people have looked at the partisan divide and literally that we've just completed a campaign where one side was saying this is all a hoax and you shouldn't wear a mask and it's okay to have big rallies, and the other side was trying to take the science-based tack. Hopefully that dynamic is going to change post-election. But this problem, the problem of the surge, is not unique to the United States by any means. It's happening in the United Kingdom. It's happening in Europe. They're experiencing the same kind of quarantine fatigue, and they're up against the same sort of brutal realities of this pandemic. Is when you start to open up, when you start to let things get back to normal socially and business-wise, you also create these opportunities for transmission, and the virus takes advantage of those, and rates start to go up. So that's really what we're up against. We need to have a cohesive national plan. We need to be united in this, and we need to continue what we're doing in Jefferson County and what I would characterize as very aggressive case investigation and contact tracing. But people have to realize that has limits. You can get to an outbreak level where it's just not possible to keep up with the outbreak. And that's been happening in areas of the state where they just do not have the time and resources to contact all the people who've been exposed. They certainly don't have resources to call people every day like we do. We call all cases, all contacts every day for the duration of their isolation and quarantine and check in on how they're doing and if they need any help staying in quarantine and all of those things. That's sort of the optimal way to do it. But if rates get too high, we'll run out of case investigators and we'll be in the situation that other counties have faced. So it really comes down to we know what to do, and very likely we're going to have to intensify these efforts over time. So move to a universal masking strategy that people who feel that they're unable to wear masks or don't want to really need to stay home. And people who are wearing face shields really need to learn how to wear masks. They're saying if you go home, you can't come back. They are that strict about it. So there are those factors that you have to look into the personal behavioral history of everyone who's going to attend that gathering. And that's a daunting task. And then the other thing you have to factor into all of this is, what are your personal risk factors for complications? So are you in one of these high risk or even medium risk groups? And if you are, our recommendation is don't do it. As hard as it is, we recommend you forego those very important family gatherings and somehow do it remotely. In other words, skip this year. Because if you guess wrong and if you are exposed at that party, and likely the person who will expose you will have no idea whatsoever that they're carrying the infection, that the asymptomatic rate is that high, then you have the infection and you're part of an outbreak. That's a really tough request that we're making. But the way things are going, it's going to become more and more necessary, especially for people coming from outbreak areas. And we have those areas in Washington State now. Hopefully our whole state won't become one. But the risk is going up. And it's going to be higher at Thanksgiving than it is now. And it's going to be higher at Christmas, I fear, than it is at Thanksgiving.
Last summer, people were hopeful, well, if I just tolerate this pandemic until summer, everything's going to be better because the weather's going to be better, it's going to be warmer and all that. From your talk about the vaccines, is there a projection about, well, maybe next summer's the time, it sounds like, where people are finally vaccinated and getting enough people vaccinated, or is it a little longer?
It could be. By next summer, those are the most hopeful projections. The most pessimistic ones are that there's going to be COVID-19 outbreaks occurring throughout 2021, and that getting vaccination levels up will take longer than we expected. But assuming that we do actually have a vaccine with 90% efficacy, that's a big deal. That shortens the timeline, because it has a profound effect on dampening outbreaks. So I'm trying to be hopeful. I'm really shooting for next summer, is we will be able to open things up a lot more, and things will return back to normal. We won't be completely COVID-free, but if you're a vaccinated individual at that point, and it's a highly effective vaccine, your ability to move around in the world and be safe and not put others at risk will be substantially different. What I'm telling the schools is everything we're doing in the schools this year will extend through the entire school year. So into the into the early summer when schools let out.
Good to know.
Yeah. Also, if there's a deadline, or if there's hope in the horizon, you can sit through the whole school day if 3 o'clock the bell's going to ring. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. One of the chief medical officer at the hospital, I gave a talk to the medical staff last week, and he likened it, this is like a roller coaster, and we're going, this is the third hill. It's the highest and it's the scariest one. But then when you're over it, the ride's over. So this is the third hill of the pandemic. And we actually expect there'll be small ripples even in the vaccine era, but just nothing like what we're going to go through in the next 3 months.
I have a question, and I offered to extend from a family member, actually, who saw Dr. Gupta from UW Health Metrics talk about that the greater efficacy of paper masks, and I'm not sure which which he was referring to. And given the higher risk incidence, there was it was perceived that he was recommending that people consider wearing paper masks for more protection. Is that something that you have heard? Is there even an adequate supply of them? Is there a change in recommendation around masking given the higher risk currently, which I don't think applies to Jefferson County necessarily, but should that be considered when traveling elsewhere, or what are you hearing?
Well, there are some differences we think that well-fitted cloth masks work as well as these kind of, it's actually kind of a synthetic woven fabric that surgical and procedural masks are made out of. But it's specifically designed as a mask material. So we think the source control benefits of them, the ability to trap droplets and aerosols, is very similar between well-fitting cloth masks and the surgical masks. But in terms of filtration, that is to say, the protection it offers the wearer when you're breathing in and it's filtering your air and removing droplets and aerosols, surgical masks are superior. Well, we know that. They're specifically designed to do that. So they have they're three-layer, and the middle layer is a filtration layer. So they're about 60-65% efficient as a filtration mask. And then the most efficient of them all is the N95 mask, which is 95% efficient. That's where it gets its name. And they're hard to wear if you're not used to it. We recommend those. And for instance, if you're flying in an airplane, especially a long flight, I would recommend, you know, finding and wearing an N95 mask. That gives you the best protection. And in answer to your question, these they often call them blue masks, since for some reason most of them are that color. Those appear to be in ample supply. A lot of them are coming from Asia, but the factories in China and South Korea and Taiwan are cranking them out, and so they're giving them away. You go to, I thought it was a good sign when I walked into Home Depot and saw a box of them just sitting there. You know, if you need a mask, take one. That's how it should be. These should be, masks should be cheap and available in all stores. So I'm sorry, that's a long-winded way of saying, but yeah, there are some benefits. And the final benefit for the surgical type masks is most people find them, or people who have trouble with cloth masks find them more comfortable to wear. Because they're specifically designed for long-term use. And they have the clips at your nose and all of those things, so they're less likely to fog up your glasses. So we recommend it all the time. If people are having trouble with cloth masks, go ahead and use the blue masks. They're fine to use.
Thank you.
And I wear them when I go to grocery stores and everything. So yeah, you know, if you're only concerned about source control, cloth mask is great. But yeah, if you're going to an area where you're not sure, I always take the blue mask with me. So a couple of the KPTZ questions, you kind of addressed one of them there. The next is, as of Thursday, the last 5 positive tests have all been in Mid-County. Are these cases connected in any way, or is this a random Mid-County outbreak?
I'll be commenting at length about this next week because we have an outbreak investigation, a social gathering, and I think it's going to be best if we get all the data together and then we'll give a report on it because it's an important community lesson. But yes, we did. We did have a party that occurred over the Halloween period that resulted in multiple cases, and a lot of people are in quarantine as a result of it, and we're testing them, and by next week we'll know the full extent of it, and I'll go through the numbers, of course protecting the privacy of those involved, but it's just. It's an example. I think we can all learn something from it. And so it's important to that we share that information with the community as best we can.
Great. So stay tuned for more information. Slightly linked to that one, when the health department asks cases to isolate and contacts to quarantine themselves, this puts a financial burden on some individuals who may not be able to afford it. We know this public health strategy works to keep us all safer, but we rarely acknowledge the real financial costs of compliance to individuals and families. Considering the numbers we see in this coming surge, how can our community step up to support this important strategy?
Yeah, that's just an extremely important question, and that life disruption and financial burden on people when they're in isolation and quarantine is huge, and we acknowledge that, and we try to call people every day and help them work through the problems and engage volunteers to help them with food delivery and chores and picking up medicines, whatever's necessary. Some counties have actually had the resources to pay people to stay in quarantine. And I think if we were a more enlightened society, we would be doing that. That's how it works in other countries. That's how it works in Canada. And they have extraordinary compliance. But generally, we don't have the resources to make up for those lost wages. A number of employers, and I've encouraged this, will quarantine can count as sick leave. That's a perfectly legitimate use of that, because it is an illness. You may or may not develop it, and we would always be happy to provide people documentation that indeed they are in a medically necessary quarantine state. So this is something our case investigators work with every day. Is everyone's in quarantine. We try to help them get through that process. And encourage that their time passes fast, and you'll be at an end of it. And I have to say our compliance with this has been extraordinary in the county. People have been willing to make this sacrifice, and we deeply appreciate that.
That's great, and recognizing that it is a sacrifice is important. Let's see. Recently, on November 2nd, the New York Times ran an article highlighting the possibility that some states were not including positive antigen tests for COVID-19 in their data of cases, and that the state of Washington is one of them. Can you explain how this affects our understanding of the disease burden in this state?
Yeah, that's a rapidly evolving situation, because the easiest test is what's known as the BinaxNOW Now test. That's just coming online. Washington State is reporting the data just in a different way. So what you see on our county website, the number that will go up to 96, we think, today, those are confirmed cases. Those are cases that have been diagnosed with the most sensitive test, the PCR test. And then the antigen tests are considered probables. And we treat them exactly the same way. And the difference between the two tests is mostly in terms of what we call sensitivity. So the antigen test will miss about a half of the cases. It really has to do with how much virus you have in the system, in your system. The antigen test is good at picking up people who have a lot of virus in their nasal passages, and it will miss the people who have low levels. But we think that the people with the high levels are the most contagious, and therefore it's important that we pick them up. So we'll be using both tests. I put out a long advisory to providers last week. There's a lot of complicated considerations, so I turned it into my five rules of rapid antigen testing. And these are the things. If you follow these five rules all the time, you won't get into trouble. If you deviate from them, you're gonna cause problems. Because, for instance, a person cannot get a rapid antigen test and then conclude, I'm sure that I don't have this infection. you can't even do that with a PCR test, but you especially can't do it with an antigen test. The state is working on better reporting, because we should report both confirmed and probable, because they are real COVID cases in it. So that's coming. It's just that this technology is moving so fast, it's hard for them to keep up with it.
Great. All right, you've made it through all the KPTZ questions. So, Mr. Morley, David Cade, any other questions for Dr. Locke? All right, well, that was very informative. Appreciate it. And we'll welcome Willie Bentz onto the screen or onto the phone. Are you with us, Willie?
Hey, yes, sir, Commissioner. Thank you.
All right, take it away. How are we doing in the DEM?
Nothing too exciting from the Emergency Operations Center. It's mostly just continues to be status quo for us. Obviously, one of our main priority over the past couple of months has been supplying folks with personal protective equipment, and we're keeping up with that. The only thing I really will mention is we're really keeping a close eye on PPE supply as cases, across the nation are starting to, skyrocket pretty severely. Obviously, that's going to increase PPE consumption. And then as we're seeing it, really across the globe and internationally, that's affecting production as well. So we're just keeping an eye on some of those supply and demand issues. Unfortunately, we remain pretty well off here locally in Jefferson County, with most of our partner agencies having 2 weeks plus worth of supply. But we're getting to that point now where the PPE stock does become a little bit of a concern as, again, both supply and demand start to increase or decrease respectively. But other than that, nothing too particularly exciting or urgent from us. So I will end it at that.
So, Willie, were you saying that we're running into PPE issues now, or you're speculating for the future?
I'm speculating. Speculating, absolutely. We're keeping an eye on things, again, kind of with the awareness that it's likely to become an issue, although we certainly hope it doesn't. But again, we fortunately built up a pretty decent buffer here locally, but we're just wanting to make sure we don't get caught off guard.
Great. Thanks. Any questions for other questions for Willie? All right. Well, thanks for the good work, Willie, and Dr. Locke as well. And I guess with that, we will I'll one more time. Any last questions? We're done early. It's great. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Willie Bentz. Thank you very much, Dr. Locke, and to the listeners of KPTZ as well. And we'll see you next week for our weekly update on the county's response to COVID-19. And we'll return to your regular scheduled programming. We'll return to ours.
This is KPTZ, Fort Townsend. We've just heard the weekly health updates on COVID-19 live from the Jefferson County Board of County Commissioners meeting at the courthouse. A recording of today's reports will be available later today for streaming online at kptz.org. And thanks again for listening.